We have all heard of the comedy team called Laurel and Hardy, sorry. Oliver Hardy was the fat guy. He was born and raised in Augusta, Georgia. And he wasn't much of a theorist about comedy. Stan Laurel was sort of the intellectual of the two, oddly enough. So they finally pinned Oliver Hardy down as to why his character was so funny. He had a very simple explanation. He said, "There's nothing dumber than a dumb man who thinks he's smart." And of course, poor old Hardy was able to convince Stan, probably the only person on earth he could convince that he was smart and knew what to do. So basically, Laurel and Hardy were the only two people on earth who believed that Oliver Hardy knew what the hell he was doing. So it made for wonderful comedy. But in the real world, dumb people who think they're smart produce things that are not really comic. For example, a century before anesthetic surgery was developed, the doctors would often give the patient a spoonful of ether to drink, and they found that that would help assuage the pain. Now, they could have made some experiments and discovered that it wasn't drinking the ether that did it. It was the ether being in your mouth, a little bit got into your lungs, and that helped the pain. Well, there weren't any articles about that in the journals. And the essence of surgery, until anesthetic surgery using ether was developed. Actually, a doctor in Georgia developed nitrous oxide before that, but he wasn't in Boston, so he was ignored. So for all of those years, surgery was a matter of speed because the patient had to be strapped down. You were cutting them open, cutting into them, and the good surgeon was the one who could finish in, say, 5 minutes. Of course, there was a lot of death and, of course, a lot of agony there. And all the time, in the same hospital, they were giving people spoonfuls of ether. So the doctors were highly intelligent. They were talking about Galen's theories that were in Latin and all that stuff. But they didn't want to bother with anything as silly as why this ether stuff was a good thing to give somebody a spoonful of. We used to have Bell Surgery from 1800, the complete set. I think my doctor brother still has it. And the procedures there give you cold chills because the doctor was in a hurry, the person was twisting in agony, and I really don't have to go into many more descriptions of what was going on, and the ether was sitting there in the hospital. The problem was the doctors didn't want to bother with anything as prosaic as checking this ether stuff out. They were too smart. They were doctors of medicine. They had studied Latin, Greek. They had studied Galen's theory that the cure to practically everything was to take blood out of people. They killed George Washington that way in December of 1799. He had pneumonia, and their cure for it was they took out, like a social scientist today, they took out a pint of blood. And that didn't work, so they took out a second pint of blood and a third pint of blood, sort of like the social scientists today say, if we just do more of this stuff, granted that so far it's been nothing but a disaster, but if we do more of it, it'll work. Now, if someone anyone without a PhD talked the way social scientists do, he would be committed to an institution. But with a PhD, if you babble, you get paid for it. As I've said before, if you babble in English, you're a fool. If you babble in Latin, you're an intellectual. This has very practical effects. Now, I have many, many times in my life been a fool. What I try to avoid is being an incurable fool. And that is what the title of this little talk is. Incurable fools. Social scientists simply will not step back and say, what I'm doing isn't working. Maybe we should be doing something else. But they're not the only ones. The opposite in our minds today of a social scientist would be the practical man. The fellow who says it doesn't work and it'll never work. Well, the practical man is always wrong, too, and for the same reason. The practical man is like the head of the U.S. Patent Office in 1898, who, as an expert on inventions, stated flatly, everything that can be invented has been invented. That was in 1898. He was respected as a very practical man. Today we have liberal commentators and conservative commentators, and like the practical man and the social science professor, they consider each other the opposites, but actually they think just alike. That's why they're able to debate each other. Now the problem with all of these people is that they're all ever-ready men, what I call ever-ready men. An ever-ready man is less intelligent than an insect. If an insect runs in, if an ever-ready man runs into a chair leg, he will just keep going and going and going and going. An insect will go around it. Social scientists get paid to keep going and going and going. When it comes to predicting the future, practical men are always wrong, just as social scientists are always wrong when they prescribe social remedies, and the problem is the same. These are both groups of incurable fools. They're not curable because they are, in one way or another, babbling in Latin instead of in English. One of the most stunning examples lately for me was the practical man's approach to allowing a person who is totally crippled, I mean not just paraplegic, but I mean to the point where he can't move his eyeballs, this person could be, in science fiction, able to influence things directly from his brain. We talk about telekinesis, which is for which there's no evidence. There's plenty of evidence for ESP. There's no evidence for the idea that one can move things with one's mind. But telekinesis is sort of like our old idea of flying. We always thought that before 1903, we always thought if we were flying, we'd have some kind of wings on, we'd look like a bird. So telekinesis is sort of like that. But, of course, we do fly at speeds before unimagined. We have to use a machine to do it. And influencing the outside world directly from your brain is something I have had a little fun with talking to practical men. I'm talking about neurologists and specialists in biotechnology. And they gave me very learned explanations of why this could not be done. I was saying it would be great if a person who was vegetating and desperate inside a body and a face that would not move could be allowed to, say, surf the internet. Well, I always get these long explanations of why this can't be done. They don't know that much about the brain. They don't know where to put the electrode. I haven't met one of them yet, oddly enough, who knows that it has, in fact, been done. You see, if you're talking about sticking an electrode in the exact part of the brain, and that is in your way, you're sort of like the ever-ready man. You've run into that chair leg, and you keep going and going and going. The scientist who actually made this work realized that you might go around that because you, the scientist sticking in the electrode, are not the only person involved. The other person involved is the guy with a brain. And the brain has developed for a billion years going around chair legs. So what they did was they combined putting the electrode in the approximate place and letting the brain grow around it. Lord knows, I don't know exactly how this was done, but basically it was done with the kind of intelligence that an insect has and a practical man doesn't. They combined two things. They stepped back and got around the chair leg because they realized that maybe there was a way around. Anybody who gets paid to comment today, and most scientists, and certainly all social scientists, make their money by a detailed study of the chair leg that they're pressing against at the moment. There's a reason for this. Of course, we start with the fact that they are less intelligent than an insect. But both they and the insect are products of evolution. The insects who couldn't get around a chair leg died. So our intelligence started with the ability to get around a chair leg. Evolution in commentary is different. We live in a world of news and academic literature, and both of those concentrate on the latest thing. I mentioned before that for a number of years, when the new discoveries in human anthropology in Africa were being made, they were also made in other places, of course, that the announcement of each new discovery of an earlier human ancestor in popular publications started with the announcement that the earliest man has been found in. And then they would describe whatever the latest finding was, and then they would, in order to make the article interesting, because most people are not really that fascinated by yet an earlier ancestor of man, unless he's the missing link. So they had to make it interesting. So they would run out and grab people who had complete theories about the man who was found in the Olduvai Gorge in South Africa, or the latest thing found in Kenya showed how man really evolved, and they'd build a complete theory of mankind on the idea that this was the earliest man. Well, that was exciting. Kind of stupid. And what really irritated me was that Science News kept using the same sort of language. The earliest man has been found in. Well, the earliest man has been found in occurred every few months. And so I wrote a little piece in there, and I pointed out that any rational person would say the earliest man found so far. Oddly enough, apparently, Science News is popular enough. It's a very good little publication, tiny little publication, a few pages long, and I think its circulation is around 1 million. But apparently, the reporters and all got hold of that and started looking on each other as fools if they said the earliest man, and all of a sudden, all these feature articles that I had seen starting with the earliest man disappeared like the mist. I was astonished at the power that the Science News had. But the point I was making was not exactly, as someone said, atomic surgery. It was pretty obvious. But the reason that people got obsessed with this idea of the latest man was a matter of evolution. They get paid for running into the latest chair leg and then running and running and running. They don't go around. That's what happens in what we call the literature in academia. You are supposed to keep up with the literature, meaning the latest articles in your field. The problem with that is you become so obsessed with where you are, and you get paid for being exactly where you are in the literature, quoting the latest articles, that nobody steps back and looks around. For example, the fact that social science programs don't work is completely ignored because no one steps back and takes a look at that. What they're doing is trying to publish articles. And articles are about whatever the latest theory is based on the earlier latest theory. And the simple fact that this is all nonsense is the last thing someone who gets paid for this kind of thing is going to do. So what we have developed is a bunch of incurable fools. People who don't have the intelligence of an insect for a very good reason. They were evolved differently. We have just taken about 1 billion years step backwards in terms of evolution. The problem is, of course, that all of the recognized experts agree with each other because they are all recognized experts. They grow up in their own environment. They evolve in their own environment. Who decides who's going to be an expert? Another expert. That was why medicine was held back for so long. All of these people read Galen's theories, bled people, and nobody stood back and said, say, you know, when somebody has pneumonia, like old George Washington did, and we take pints of blood out of him, he tends to die. Well, that's completely absurd. I mean, why would somebody bring up something like that? I'm serious. Why would you bring it up? You're not going to get published. You're going to be laughed out of the medical profession. You're going to show that you really don't understand Latin, which is what Galen wrote in. This is a different environment. An insect has to survive. And by survival, this means he's got to eat and reproduce. A professor has got to impress other professors. Practical men are the same way. Practical men have to influence or be approved by other practical men. There is a whole field called futurology. Now, people get paid for it. But futurology has nothing to do with the future. Think about it. How many times have you ever heard of any futurologist who was wrong, shown to be wrong, and suffered for it? See, if an insect doesn't go around a chair leg, he dies. If Arthur Schlesinger says that, which he always said, that the government would run the economy much more efficiently than business would, and there's no such thing as a free market is absurd, well, pretty well everybody has gotten over that idea, but Arthur Schlesinger didn't pay a penny for it. Neither did Galbraith, and Karl Marx is still a genius of economic There's nothing wrong with being wrong. And that is the problem. An insect has to survive by eating and reproducing. An intellectual or a practical man survives by the opinion of others. And the opinion of others has to do with whatever the latest thing is. He has to be right up on the latest thing. Well, in order to actually predict what's going to happen over the next few decades, you have to start by looking at the last few decades and at history in general. Those are not the kind of commentators we have. The kind of commentators we have, you'll see all over the internet. They know all about the latest thing. Well, of course, while they're running into that chair leg, some other latest things, the thing that's going to be the latest thing, is probably happening on the other end of the world. But that doesn't matter because you don't get paid for writing about what's going to happen and actually happen in the future. Nobody's going to check you. Futurologists do not get paid for predicting the future. They get paid for saying what sounds good right now, which is why they're always wrong. Because, again, they've studied the latest newspaper. The average person doesn't remember the headlines 1 year ago. You'd be astonished if you went back and looked at what people considered important just 1 year ago. I was doing a TV interview last week about Stormfront, and the interviewer asked me, well, why? Some people would want to know, she said, why you are interested. Well, to start with, what I had said was, what I keep saying, is that there is a program underway of genocide against the white race. That is to say, they want to solve this, quote, race problem, unquote. Everybody, every respectable conservative and every liberal says, and agrees, you have to agree to this in order to get on television, that this race problem will be solved by massive third world immigration into all white countries and only into white countries. Japan is less crowded than the Netherlands, but we insist you have to want the Netherlands to become a multiracial society, but not Japan. Well, it so happens that the Netherlands is white. Then the next question I was asked was, well, a lot of people would wonder why they should be concerned about this. Well, I had also added that if I were to say there's this race problem in the world, and this race problem needs to be solved by massive non-black immigration into Jamaica, Belize, Haiti, every African country, and I would just go ahead and list every predominantly black country on earth and stop there and say, of course, nobody else has to do this, but just happens that these are the countries that have this race problem that needs to be solved. Having pointed this out, I said, now how long do you think it would take any reasonably intelligent person to understand that what I was referring to as the race problem was actually the black problem? It wouldn't take long to understand that. That was right after I had talked about the fact that this race problem has to be solved by having massive third world immigration integration into every white country and only into white countries. The next question the interviewer asked was, well, why? A lot of people want to know why you're concerned about this. And I said, if I had the same program that I just told you about, that there should be massive non-black immigration into every black country and only into black countries, You would not ask a black man why he is concerned about this. Any sane black man would be up in arms about it. And you would not be asking, well, goodness gracious, why are you upset about this final solution to the black problem? Now, in saying this, I was telling the truth because I am smarter than the average insect. Meanwhile, all the other people who are talking about race are talking about the latest news, the latest riots. They're talking about what so-and-so said that was outrageous. They would have told the interviewer, well, some people say this, well, I say that, and I read the latest article by so-and-so. What I do is I step back and I get around the chair leg. A lot of us are despairing over this chair leg, that people have this particular attitude, but we don't go around it. We don't take on reality. The reality is that this is a program of genocide, and that is what we are against. And that's what any sane person would be against, not only applied to his own race, but applied to any race. And this takes us to another point. Everybody assumes that a white man would be worried if there were an anti-black program. They also assume that no black person can possibly be upset at a program of genocide against whites. That happens to be true. Why is it true? Because we assume that black people don't have that kind of morality. Whites do. Now, that's an interesting thought. The idea that a white person could say, I don't want my race destroyed, the most any non-white will say is, well, you have your right to your point of view. But if a black person's race were about to be destroyed, you would absolutely expect white people to raise hell about it and help protect not only another race, but another species. We're fighting over spotted owls. But at the same time, we can't understand someone who talks about the white race. But again, if you spend all your time banging into that chair leg about present attitudes and nasty statements and stuff like that and the latest opinion, then you're going to lose. Just like any insect, you're going to die. The early insects that wouldn't get around the chair leg died. And that is why most pro-white movements die. They don't look at, they don't go around the chair leg. Actually, that interview, I think, went very well. There wasn't a thing I said that was the slightest bit exceptional. Because, as I say, I'm smarter than the average insect, or the average political commentator, or the average social scientist. I can step back and take a look, like an insect does, and get around the chair leg. By the way, I've gotten this far talking about specific examples of incurable fools, and this doesn't just apply to fools. I was talking about liberals, conservatives, social scientists, and people who call themselves practical men. There's another group that I have discussed before, what I call the weakest generation, and their entire history. That entire generation gave a third of the world to the communists. When the World War II generation came of age, the white man walked the earth like a colossus. And by the time they got through giving everything up, all the discrimination was against us. We were apologizing for our very existence, which is what we're doing today. Every liberal, every conservative must agree that the white race has to go. This, they talk about the, quote, race problem, unquote. And they all have to agree that this race problem will be solved by massive third world immigration into every white country and only into white countries. We have what we call, what Bob Twain calls the battered white syndrome, to the point where you can rape our women, you can kill us on the streets, and all we'll do is apologize for lynchings that happened 100 years ago. Oh, the list goes on and on, but we all know what I'm talking about. And as I have said over and over, and no one else seems to want to repeat, as a mantra, this thing about if today Bob Whitaker, with his southern accent, were to say, you know, the world has this race problem, and the way we're going to solve this race problem is to have massive non-black immigration into certain countries, Jamaica, Haiti, Belize, every country in sub-Saharan Africa. I would carefully list every single black country and say that's where the race problem has to be solved. And nobody in this situation would dare to ask me, what about the race problem in America or Europe or anywhere? I'd say, well, you know, we know that, because we have this race problem in the black countries. And I don't think it would take anybody with the intelligence, with an intelligence above an insect, to realize that what I was talking about was the final solution to the black problem, not a race problem. But again, as I say, I'm quite serious. The level of intelligence of an insect is something that we forbid anyone in our society from having. Now, the World War II generation, so what I'm saying is, if people kept hearing this enough, it would devastate. Then David Duke could talk, then Jared Taylor could talk, if they would just lead off with this genocide statement. But I have a very hard time getting my propaganda across, because it's so simple, and it is not the final solution to anything. David Duke has solutions. Jared Taylor has solutions. All I have is means by which to get in the enemy's fortress, to be able to talk. Now, the World War II generation, it wasn't so much a matter of intelligence as it was courage. In their case, they are the most, morally speaking, they were the most cowardly generation in this country's history, and just possibly in any country's history. They gave up everything. We are in this position where the race problem and anti-racism are simply code words for getting rid of the white race. Anti-racist means anti-white today. It's the same thing. And that generation was the one that was just too weak to challenge it. But they have the same problem. As a generation, they had the same problem that the social scientists have, and as the people who call them practical men have, and as the common conservative and liberal commentators have. That is, how can we be stupid if we've got PhDs, or if we've got $1 million, or if we're national commentators? We can't be stupid. We must be smart. And there's nothing dumber than a dumb man who thinks he's smart. And that is a general problem. Well, you have the same problem with a coward who thinks he's brave. The one thing nobody dared say about the World War II generation was that morally, they were cowards. They were incredible cowards. They would never stand up to anybody who was attacking the white people or attacking America or anything else. They would sort of say, well, I was in World War II, and that was about it. And when a World War II veteran walking around in his little paper hat would say, as I remember them saying, well, I fought a war so that there wouldn't be any discrimination against people, that the borders would be open and third worlders could come into America. I've heard them say that. What I haven't heard is all those World War II types who would say, that's nonsense, they never say it publicly. They never had any moral courage. None. Zero. Zilch. I don't know of any moral courage they had. And of course, as I have pointed out many times before, it's good for your macho to be a war hero, but in the real world, no war hero has ever made the slightest difference in world history. Think about that. No war hero has ever made the slightest difference in world history. Moral courage makes history. And that was what they lacked, and that we have the same problem in the World War II generation. Nobody dares say they were cowards because they fought World War II. Well, they were cowards, on and on and on. They had the courage and the individuality beaten out of them in that ridiculous World War II type basic training. And then, over half of them went on to use the GI Bill of Rights to go to college. They were already beaten down to the point where they had no individuality at all, no independence at all, which is was the purpose of basic and the general military training. Shows them the government's bigger than they are. Can't fight City Hall. Then they went to college and learned from the professors that professors should rule the world, which is really what liberalism and socialism and all that is, the idea that military men and businessmen and all these other people have resources, they have money and power, which the college professors, meaning that is to say the intellectuals like Karl Marx or Arthur Schlesinger or some of these clowns, should have. And every little Bush League professor thinks that he is the intellectual he's talking about. So he has this captive group of students there, and as he talks and talks and talks, he begins to actually believe that everybody else is being unreasonable and only he in his classroom is being reasonable. He should have all this power. He should have all these grants. He should be one of the intellectuals who runs things. And that's all really liberalism and socialism fall down to, is turning the world over to a bunch of people who fancy themselves to be intellectuals. So we have this problem of incurable fools, the fact that what they tried didn't work, does not have any influence on a professor. He still says exactly what he said 40 years ago. One of the most interesting things that I noticed, and nobody else seemed to notice, was that socialism said that the Karl Marxes, the Trotskys, and the professors should rule the world. Well, the day that the communists collapsed all the way from the Berlin Wall to Siberia, that from that time on, every single professor who was a liberal or a socialist has suddenly become, overnight, an environmentalist. Why? Very simple. Environmentalists say that professors should rule the world. That it has to be up to a bunch of college professors, quote, intellectuals, unquote, to plan the world's economy to save the environment. Now, 40 years ago, they had to rule the world. The college professors had to rule the world. And the commentators and these people, they all had to rule the world for the sake of the working class. Not that any of them had ever done any work. Certainly neither Lenin nor Marx ever did a day's work in their lives. But they the day that that excuse got so ridiculous that the entire Soviet empire collapsed, that day, all those same professors suddenly became environmentalists. The reason is pretty obvious if you know it. O'Reilly is always saying, I don't understand why professors are so left-wing. Well, that's what left-wing is the idea that professors should rule the world, and now it's called environmentalism. It's the same thing. There's not the slightest change. Look at the names of the people who went from being pro-Soviet to being environmentalists overnight. There's a lot to be done in the environment. I don't believe the economic system that we have is particularly just. There's a lot of difference between that and the idea of handing the whole damn thing over to a bunch of professors. And they are looking for power. They're not looking to help the environment or the working class or anything else. And people don't say that these people who supported this insane communist economic system, nobody holds them to account for it because they got PhDs. They can't be just a bunch of blubbering idiots. They can say it in Latin. And, of course, same thing is true from the World War II. The guy runs around in his little paper hat and gives everything away and never dares to speak up and never dares to challenge the anti-whites. And he says, oh, no, I'm not a coward. I'm really a hero. I was out there fighting racism, man. I've got medals. Look at these medals. Look at this paper hat of mine. Look at this pretty paper hat I got, man. I'm a hero. He is not only is he a coward, a moral coward, he is an incurable moral coward. And those of the people who refuse to say it are the ones who let him get away with it, just as the people who let liberals, the conservatives, the practical men and the social science professors get away with babbling because they've got titles or money. You cannot learn if you don't know that you are ignorant of many things. You cannot show courage if you think you are the embodiment of courage already. You become hopeless. You become incurable unless you can face those facts. And if people are afraid to tell you, as they are with professors, that he's a moron with a PhD, or World War II moral coward, to tell him that he is a moral coward, medals and all, then they are incurable. An idiot is an idiot. If he babbles in Greek, Latin, Arabic, Hebrew, English, or anything else, the only thing you're going to do for a fool, by not calling him a fool, is to make him incurable.